Now we have David Grimm, the editor for our daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent online stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on a surprise in Brazil. Perhaps the mention of Brazil at this point in time only brings to mind the ongoing World Cup matches. But another event has put Brazil in the headlines this week. Right, Dave?
That's right, Sarah. This is a very interesting story about an uncontacted tribe in the forests of the Amazon. And believe it or not, there are still tribes out there in this world that have not had contact with the outside world. And this is one of those tribes. This tribe lived in very dense rainforest and was along the upper Envira River in the state of Acre.
What actually prompted this contact from the tribe?
Well, researchers are a little unclear, but there's some speculation that a lot of these tribes have been forced into closer contact with other people, either due to things like logging, the cocaine trade, other people occupying these areas. And this particular tribe, which is probably composed of about three dozen individuals, actually seems to have been raiding some of the local villages and trying to steal things like machetes and other tools, which suggests that there was a conflict that was about to happen. And what's really fascinating here is it seems that this tribe actually willingly made contact with the outside world. Late last month, a group of them approached a team of Brazilian government scientists and sort of made themselves known.
You know, as you said before, this isn't the only uncontacted tribe that the Brazilian government knows about. And in fact, other uncontacted tribes have come to the surface over the decades. Those encounters have had some pretty grim results. What can be done to prevent the same things from happening again?
Right. One of the big problems is they have been tribes in the past. And what happens is when they come into contact with the outside world, they tend to come down with some diseases that we don't really think about a whole lot anymore. Things like whooping cough, other diseases caught from people that these people have no immunity to. That's a real concern with this new group as well. And so what experts are saying is one of the really important things that has to happen is constant medical supervision of these people to make sure that their first contact with the outside world isn't a fatal one.
So do the researchers that are helping with this and are observing these tribes from afar, do they know anything about why some of the tribes choose isolation?
Well, we might think that a lot of these tribes choose isolation because they just don't want to have anything to do with the outside world. But one of the experts says that actually a lot of them are curious about other people and the rest of the world, but they're just afraid. And that's what keeps them isolated.
Next up, we have a story on a potential new sniffer. If you've ever been to a science museum, you've probably seen and maybe even touched a Van de Graaff generator. These are shiny metal spheres that, when touched, cause one's hair to stand on end. And now researchers have found a new practical use for these devices.
That's right, more than making your hair stand on end anyways. What is interesting about these generators is they don't just make goofy fun at the science museum. They actually apply about 400,000 volts to your body, which, believe it or not, is safe. But what that does is it actually electrostatically charges the skin's surface. Now, here's why that's important. There's a machine that's commonly used in laboratories called a mass spectrometer. What this machine does is it identifies what a substance is by ionizing it, that is giving that substance an electrical charge, whether it's a vial of proteins or DNA or what have you. The question is, could we do something similar with human skin? And you could think of applications for that if you're traveling through the airport. Do you have drugs on your body? Do you have maybe bomb residue on your body? Even things like alcohol intoxication screening. But the question is, how do you ionize all the stuff that's on your body? And that's where the Van de Graaff generator comes in.
They tried this on real people. And I have two questions. Did their hair stand up? And two, what were they able to detect when they ionized the chemicals on the skin of the people?
Right. They only tried this on one person, actually, and his hair did stand up. And he basically had on his body various things. He had substances like explosive residue, solvents, flammable solvents, cocaine, even acetaminophen. And what he did was he touched the Van de Graaff generator with one hand, and with the other hand, he pointed very close to the mass spectrometer. The mass spectrometer was actually able to pick up these electrically charged particles on his skin, and lo and behold, it was able to identify what these particles were.
The theme of this article seems to be that you could bring this to the airport and suddenly start a whole new detection regime on passengers. How far away is that scenario?
Well, this is still pretty much in the prototype phase right now, but researchers do say that they feel like this is a much cheaper, potentially more accurate alternative to some of the other stuff that we've got out there. Definitely less invasive, unless you consider being shocked by 400,000 volts invasive.
So lastly, we have a story on the panda diet. Pandas live on a restricted diet. They're not just vegetarian, but bambooitarian, as in they only eat the bamboo plant. Being pretty hefty bears, this has long had researchers wondering how exactly they get all the nutrition they need from such a woody plant. So, Dave, do they have specialized guts for this?
They don't, actually, and that's something you might expect. But pandas are a type of bear, and most bears are carnivores, which means pandas pretty much have the same mechanics as any other bear. They've got a simple stomach and a short, small intestine, which is really perfect for digesting meat, not so great for digesting plants, especially an all-bamboo diet. They certainly don't have the four stomachs that cows have, which you really need to be able to process plants efficiently.
In this study, the researchers spent a really long time following bears around, about 6 years. Where were they and what measurements were they taking?
They were in the mountains of China, and what they were trying to figure out is exactly what are these pandas eating that's helping them survive. And they looked at three main nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and calcium, in the bamboo plants that the pandas ate.
So they bring together two factors here, the nutritional content of the plants and the location of the bears. What conclusions were they able to come to?
Well, what they found is that these pandas perform a pretty intricate juggling act in order to survive. They're constantly switching off not only what type of bamboo they're eating, but even the part of the bamboo plant that they're eating. So, for example, during mating season in the spring, pandas are feeding on young wood bamboo shoots, which are rich in nitrogen and phosphorus. In June, when the wood bamboo shoots have matured and they contain fewer nutrients, the pandas migrate to higher elevations and start eating young arrow bamboo shoots. And then when the nutrients of these bamboo shoots start to decline, and also neither of these is very high in calcium, which the pandas also need, the pandas next switch sometime in mid-July to young arrow bamboo leaves, which are rich in calcium.
Chasing their nutritional components all across these different areas has some repercussions for their offspring, right?
That's right. Pandas have a sort of unusual reproductive cycle. Their embryos actually undergo something called delayed implantation, where the embryo stays in a state of arrested development in the mother's uterus until it attaches and resumes growth. And this is all tied to the availability of calcium. So when the mother gets pregnant, not enough calcium is available to properly nourish the fetus. And so the fetus actually has to sort of suspend its development until these plants or the parts of the plants that the pandas really need to eat that are rich in calcium start growing, and then the fetus can resume development again.
So not only do they have trouble with giving birth to babies, but they also suffer in the winters?
These pandas have, because they have this very complicated juggling act, there's little left to chance. And even when they do things perfectly, they're still really dealing with very low nutrient levels in their diet. This is especially a problem in the winter when nutrient levels drop a lot. And that helps explain why researchers have observed a lot of panda deaths occurring right in the months following the winter.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about a bird, an ancient bird, with the longest known wingspan of any bird. It's actually longer than a stretch limousine. Also a story about physicists spotting the source of mysterious oh my God particles. That's actually what some people call them. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about six vials of smallpox that have turned up in a U.S. laboratory. Also a story about why European neuroscientists are rebelling against the European Union's Human Brain Project. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. This segment is part of the Science Podcast. You can hear the whole show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and the Science website, www.sciencemag.org.